Hey everyone, this is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome back to the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. This is a super extra special episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast, not only because of who is on it, but also because what it represents. This is actually our fifth anniversary of releasing the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. The first episode went out in March 2020, March 16th by my best recollection, so we're right around the five-year mark. As I said on LinkedIn, this has been the best 5 years of my career, putting this podcast together for you, and of course, building out our other podcasts and our events and our digital meetings and whatnot. So I just wanted to say thank you for being part of this experience. It's been just such a special time, and I'm really grateful to everyone who has appeared on the podcast, to all of our great sponsors, and of course, to you, our fantastic listeners. So thank you again for all of your support. So in honor of this special episode, we've got a lot going on. We'll have Chris Newmarker opening up, of course, with the Newmarker's Newsmakers, the highlights for Mass Device this week. Then I'll have a conversation with Joe Mullings and Steve Bell, two surgical robotics experts who both will be at Device Talks Boston. We'll talk about the state of surgical robotics on there. We'll talk about the increasingly influential role that cardiac surgeons are playing with surgical robotics, which is an interesting twist. And Joe lets a secret slip about a major OEM. So enjoy that as well. And once again, both Steve and Joe will be at Device Talks Boston, which is happening on April 30th and May 1st. We would love to see you there. Go to boston.devicetalks.com to register. And then after I talk with Joe and Steve, I will have my keynote conversation with Todd Langevin. He is the president of Biotronic Neuro, which is the neuro arm of Biotronic, as the name suggests. And Todd's been in the neuro industry for a few decades and has a lot of insights. This is obviously an area where we're seeing a lot of interest. It was the case when I interviewed Todd a couple of weeks ago. It was again the case this week. We had a lot of neuro news on Mass Device. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about where neuro has been and where it is going. And then, of course, we'll talk about Bionutronic's spinal cord stimulation system, which actually represents, I think, a pretty cool use of connected health and something that could really, really help patients. So really enjoyed that conversation with Todd. And before I begin this episode, I did want to invite you to our Device Talks Tuesdays. It's coming up Tuesday at 4 p.m. with our friends from Resonetics. We'll have a conversation about Nitinol. You can go to devicetalks.com to register for that. That is free. You can ask your questions and get them answered if you're watching live, or you'll get them answered soon after if you're watching on demand. Either way, it's going to be a great an hour well spent, so make sure you do that. And, of course, join us at Device Talks Minnesota on June 11th. The agenda is shaped. It is continuing to shape. We're continuing to bring in speakers, and we'd love to see you there. So go to minnesota.devicetalks.com to register for that. All right, without any further delay, let's begin this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Marker, how are you, sir?
Doing well, Tom. Doing well. How you doing, man?
Doing well. We have a big event. Me and you. This is our. I'm calling this our anniversary. Our Device Talks podcast anniversary. I know we've hinted at it, but I looked at the first podcast, and it was posted on WordPress with the date March 16th. So probably
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I think I was posting on Sunday nights back then. I think I was like finishing it on Friday, but then not posting till Sunday night. But let's just say this is our 5 year anniversary. So happy anniversary, Chris.
Happy anniversary, Tom. What's the traditional number for what's the traditional thing for five? Is it the gold anniversary?
No, it must be paper. I'm sure someone out there knows that.
There, it's like
maybe it's beer.
Beer anniversary. Happy beer-versary.
Happy beer-versary. So yes, we've been at this for 5 years. I've had over 300 episodes.
My gosh.
This is on the podcast network, so this is not just Device Talks Weekly. Over a million plays, so hundreds of guests. hundreds of thousands of newsmakers. So lots to celebrate.
I mean, the pandemic were rough times, but I think this was, I would say this was probably the great silver lining for the medtech industry, that we got this going. You know,
well, for the medtech, I was going to say for myself, for the medtech industry.
Yeah, for myself.
I like your thinking, Chris Neuwacher. This might be the most important thing that's ever happened to mankind, is this podcast.
I love it. That sounds great. Let's go with
all
it.
All right. We are changing the world.
We are. People are listening to saying those dudes are out of control.
Exactly. But we do have a purpose, folks, and that's to bring you the news of the week.
Exactly.
Chris Neuwacher. These are ripped from the pages of Mass Device and its affiliated publications, and you can't rip a computer, but you know what I mean, folks. Work with me here.
Yeah.
What is number five on the Neuwacher's Newsmakers
Tom
list?
Tom was using old expressions, but fresh.
Tear it off the old teletype.
All the teletype. Yes. So number five on the list, I've got a, I wrote this today, a Thursday. Yes.
Chris
Neuwacher. That's right. Yeah. I'm writing things. I'm getting things out there. You know, this is a roundup of how medtech stocks have, among the largest companies, have been performing over the last week with all the turmoil that we've been, seeing around, tariffs and economic announcements out of the government. And, I kind of looked at the Dow Jones Industrial Average down more than 4% over the last 5 days. The S&P 500 down more than 3% over the past 5 days. But then when I, looked at some of the largest companies in our industry, there definitely are a few companies that are especially taking a hit right now, and one of the top ones is Intuitive, and that's they've discussed with the analyst about how many of their surgical robotics instruments are made in Mexico, and so it looks like investors are especially sensitive to what this could mean for Intuitive, and then also noticed that both Boston, Scientific and Stryker, been down more, over the past 5 days as well. Which I saw you were on Twitter, you keyed into the same, Truist report that, I saw, with Richard Neuwetter, and he was saying that, Stryker management at the AOS 2025 event in San Diego this week, we're kind of talking about what was the phrase, a new normal, basically.
They had and first of all, I commend you for slipping back into 2020 mode by saying, I said on Twitter. Twitter, of course, is now X.
You said on LinkedIn.
I said on LinkedIn, but anyway,
you changed my mind.
You have slipped back
in
time.
Put me on a 2020 mode.
But Stryker management had a breakfast with analysts, and you could sort of see them just sitting back and saying, "Well, this is just what we've got. The we have to deal with this new normal of government kind of doing and then undoing things, and we'll have to learn to live with it." Which is, I guess, a stoic and healthy way of looking at it. But this is an interesting numbers. Folks should take a look at this article. Zimmer Biomet, the only one that's seen a plus. We will have Ivan Tonos at Device Talks Boston, and we'll talk about all that they're doing. And in a conversation that we'll run in a couple of weeks that we did at the Mulling Studio, Ivan Tonos talked about the transformation of Zimmer Biomet that's been going on since he joined. Much more deeper bench, much more broader offerings. So something they did allowed them to gain 1.4% over the last five days, when most, if not all, the others on your list, the major OEMs, have lost stock price. So
exactly,
I mean, it's 5 days, so I don't know what can be drawn from it, but they're doing something right. So give them Zimmer Biomet a round of applause.
There you go. Yeah. All right. So number four on the list. And just to add really quick as well, Avamed, has been lobbying the Trump administration to get the industry an exemption they had in the same way that they had, during the first Trump administration with the Chinese tariffs. So fingers crossed the industry can achieve that.
We'll see. We'll see, hopefully. All right, number four.
Number four on the list. We've got, Medtronic was releasing positive results from a 2-year trial of its Evolut TAVR, And Medtronic was saying that this demonstrated superior valve, performance, and patients that had small aortic annuli. So more, some more positive data to back up Medtronic and its TAVR. It's in a very competitive situation with Edwards Life Sciences, with their Sapien valve. So some positive news, it seems, here out of Medtronic this week.
I feel like we've been talking about the heart a lot lately, both in the interviews you've done with Syncardia and Antares Technologies. And we're seeing a lot of news on the structural heart front. So I'm not sure if it's just, again, the I'm noticing it now bias, but there's definitely a lot going on in this space, and certainly good news for Medtronic.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's just like this whole trend of like all the stuff moving into the cath lab, and there's so many procedures for the heart that can get involved with that. So it's just a lot of exciting innovation going on right now. Number three on the list, another exciting area of med tech, which is brain computer interfaces, and a lot of BCI news this mm-hmm. week. Actually, but go to Mass Device, go to our neurology a section on Mass Device, and you'll be able to go through all of that. But the one that got the most attention was Paradromics, saying that they expect to launch a study this year of their BCI, and they've appointed this Austin, Texas based company has appointed principal investigators for the study out of UC Davis, Sacramento, and Mass General. So there you go. Mm-hmm. So this will be studied over at Mass General, and they're going to be enrolling people with speech impairments due to progressive neuromuscular disease.
What a great pursuit to be able to develop devices that help people regain some of the functions and some of the lives they lost.
Like, absolutely.
Just the ability to communicate, to function somewhat independently. Super cool stuff.
So they could regain the ability to communicate.
Oh my God, can you imagine?
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
So great work.
And the fact that we got so many companies now in this space, and they're going to be, they recently got a investment with some Saudi money, and they're going to be getting going on the a study of the BCI this year. So this is this is great. Moving forward there.
Folks should definitely take a look at Mass Device. I think you've had like maybe 8 or 9 neuro-related stories this week. It's been outrageous.
So. It's been a week. There's just been a lot of stuff going on. It's a really exciting space right now.
Absolutely. All right, Chris Neumacher, what's number two?
So, we covered the minimally invasive. We covered, the brain computer interfaces and the other space that's super exciting right now. There's a few others, but I mean this one definitely. I mean surgical robotics. And, mm-hmm. We have news out of Stryker, at the AAOS 2025 show. They launched their fourth generation Mako system, the Mako 4.
Yeah, this is a really interesting launch. And I had in my LinkedIn post a conversation I had with Kevin Lobo a few years ago when he talked about the ability of Mako to do hips and knees and shoulders and spine, and how it makes a great deal of sense for a hospital to, get the system because it could be used by so many different specialties. And it just kind of continues, as you said in my post, kind of continues to build a moat around hard tissue for Stryker.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they've been really successful with this, it's almost in the same way the Intuitive, with the Da Vinci 5 launch mm-hmm. last year, kind of like really, I mean, just really further moved the goalpost for anybody who wants to compete with them. It definitely seems like Stryker's done this to a degree as well with this with this Mako 4 launch. So just really really big news from them out of this whole show. And also go to Mass Device, and we've been this was by Sean Hooley. I should say the Medtronic TAVR story was from senior editor Daniel Kirsch, but we've been like cranking out news out of AAOS this week, and I'd say definitely expect a roundup out of the show by early next week as well. But just a lot of news in the orthopedic space, and then coming to number one. So I mean, Stryker's on this list, of course. Intuitive's on this list, Medtronic's on this list, but I have a I posted a 10 surgical robotics companies you need to know roundup on Mass Device. I was kind of taking some of these companies that we know are just extremely important, and then, you know, I kind of listed off, you know, the companies that we've got like disclosed money raising amounts from, and kind of like adding them to this, you know, top 10 list, you know, to kind of make, you know, this like 10 list of 10. And, you know, and we have information on even more companies that, you know, we've covered with our free surgical robotic special report that you can, you know, download on Mass Device.
And what will it cost them, Chris?
It will cost them nothing. It is free.
Nothing.
Nothing.
Are you
exactly.
saying just a little bit of information?
Just a little bit of information. I mean, just, yeah, just, you know, like name, email, what you do.
No, it's a great report.
Yeah.
It's really sharp, really well. The reporting is great. It's thorough. The design is great. And it's the program everyone needs if they're trying to keep track of what's going on in the surgical robotics space. I think you have 57, you said?
Yeah, 57 companies this year. We really tried to get information on every company that we've covered on Mass Device and MDO in recent years. And I see us adding even more and more companies to this report in future editions, you know, in coming years. So, yeah, it's really exciting.
Awesome stuff.
Awesome.
All right, Chris. And, of course, I'll be hosting the Device Talks Tuesday's Surgical Robotics Series. That'll be the week of April 8th. And then the following week, Jim Hammerand at Medical Design and Outsourcing will be hosting a webinar with the head of R&D at Capstan Medical. So folks, if they want to learn directly from the surgical robotics leaders, I'll have folks from SSI Innovations, EndoQuest, and Lupin, which is a robot in the dentistry space, which is a new and emerging space for robotics. So you can register for all of those on to devicedocs.com for mine, or Medical Design and Outsourcing for MDO's webinar. So keep a lookout in your inbox. We'll send you some information about how to register for those.
Fantastic.
All right, Chris Neumacher, great list as always.
Great, man.
All right, have a good day.
Yeah, you too. Have a good one, man.
All right, well, that concludes our Neumacher's Newsmakers. Now let's hear my conversation with Joe Mullings of the Mullings Group and surgical robotics expert, Steve Bell.
Hey, everyone. This is Tom Salome of Device Talks. We're here speaking with some of our speakers who will be at Device Talks Boston on April 30th and May 1st. And I'm beyond pleased that Steve Bell, the surgical robotics expert, will be giving a presentation at Device Talks Boston, bringing our community up to date on where the heck this whole thing is headed. So we're going to get a preview of that overview here today. Very happy to have Steve Bell with us. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Great to see you both. Great to see you today.
Yes, and of course, Joe Mullings, my other surgical robotics expert here by my side. And I'm just going to roll the ball out into the field and let you folks have at it, because I really enjoy watching the back and forth and the banter. So, Steve, I don't want to at all influence what you're going to talk about at Device Talks Boston. So I'll hit upon some very basic points here, but if you want to go in a different direction of Boston, feel free, but I think we're going to hit upon some of that, some of what you'll be covering. So first, let's start with the big players, the existing players. Let's handicap where they are. Let me guess, Intuitive's probably a number one right now, but there's some others moving into the space, moving along the clinical and regulatory pathways. If we're looking at the existing sellers of surgical robotic systems, who's doing what, who's moving forward, who's standing still?
Great question. So clearly Intuitive is number one, and not by a small amount. I think they're like, you know, just so far ahead at the minute. Well, you know, 25 years is to be expected. I think that, you know, if it was ranking, you know, who's potentially in the US going to come in as number two, then, you know, you've got Medtronic very close. They should be getting a clearance very soon. So they're ahead in terms of, you know, having done the IDEs and done all the hard work there. I guess they're just waiting on FDA now. And then of the other large strategic is J&J, and they are, you know, a fair way behind, but great to see they got in December their clearance to do their IDE. So I would expect, or I would be guessing, that by now they're getting into the first clinicals, you know, anytime in either the last few weeks or the next few weeks, they'll be doing their first clinicals. So from the three of the big players, I would rank them long way out in front, Intuitive. Long way behind in second place is Medtronic, but they're on the cusp of being able to get commercially cleared. And then you've got J&J in third position, a lot of work to do to catch up. They've got to get through their IDE. So that's from the big players. Don't know, Joe, do you sort of see it that way as well, or?
Yeah, I would say from the big players, but I'm also going to make sure we don't sleep on a few others, right? You've got a Sensus who's already got a 510 cleared robot on Senhance, and then pulling Luna up behind that with the power of a Stortz and that huge, I think, I don't know if it's 12,000 install base. I think that's the number. So I wouldn't sleep on that one. That's a little while off, but they should have a more clear path there. And I think that they're positioned also as a company that's ready to sell robotics. I'm still not convinced that J&J and Medtronic are positioned in order to sell robotics the way they need to sell it. Because if they're going to go with their same sales force, they're going to have challenges there. But I would say for the three big strategics, I'd go with Steve there. And then I also wouldn't sleep on CMR. And then, of course, you have Distal Motion and Moon, which represent sort of a different bit of case acuity. So I'm curious what Steve's take is on those as well.
Yeah, no, I agree. And CMR, fantastic that they've got FDA clearance as well. So they're in a position now to actually go commercial. I think CMR offers a really good alternative for people. It's a modular versus the Intuitive, which is the single boom. So that's a nice choice for people. I think the other thing that people will get with CMR is that they see this 30,000 cases out there already that have been done. So it works. So I think that will remove some of that anxiety for them. I think going into the other categories, I think the Distal Motions and the Moon Surgicals, I think that, we've said this a few times, it's a smart approach because it's not trying to run straight through the same door as Intuitive. And I think that by going more towards either a laparoscopic mixed procedure with distal that they can do with their sterile console and the bringing the robot in when it's needed in the right part of the procedure, or with Moon, which is a laparoscopic 2.0, as you say, Joe, your words, and I agree with that. I think that that's a smart way to go. All three of them have the same problem, which is just size, scale, reach in the US. And I think you said it 100 times, Joe, just because you bring all three European robots across the pond and you plonk them down in the US, that doesn't give you a right to win. There's a lot to do to give a right to win in the US. But yeah, I agree. Those three are there. And you do mention a census. I think it's going to be a renewed push again now that with Stortz. And I think that a census is just a hold the fort till Luna gets there. And then Luna will be the big push that, yeah, I think if Stortz is sensible, that's what they'll try and do.
Yeah, agree with that too. And I also, when we talk about overseas, you got CMR with 30,000 cases. You also got SS Innovation, SSI, and they represent a different type of organization. They're the only organization out there that represents what Intuitive stood for 20 years ago. Is they're a digital surgery company who's got multiple products already and the capability to deploy other types of digital surgery solutions, where most of the others we're talking about are a single product platform. So I think from the cost perspective, developing out of India, what they have put together over there on a product development team is substantial. So I think what happens there, it'll be interesting to see who comes in and potentially acquires them or partners with them, because you get a product pipeline versus a product when you look at SS Innovation, in my opinion.
Sudhir and his team over there are doing brilliant stuff. I think that the differentiation in cardiac for me is massive, right? So you had back in the old days, the SI was very much a cardiac capable. Some people do use the XI, but it's kind of a lost art. I think because Sudhir is a cardiac surgeon, he leads from the front on the cardiac. And the one thing that I will say for everybody is you've got to have a story, right? You've got to be able to come to the market with a pitch or a story or a differentiation or a Trojan horse that'll get you in. And I think if they come to any of the markets, working with the cardiac surgeons, anyone who's in this business knows that the cardiac surgeon has punching power. And if a group of cardiac surgeons say, you know what, we want this in, it's going to be very hard for an administration to say, oh, but, you know, we'd like you to take an XI, or we'd like you to take some, you know, a Hugo or something. So I think a smart thing by them is to continue to push that pipeline of products on the cardiac side, the anastomotic coupler that they're working on. The telesurgery with cardiac, again, another, you know, another really big differentiator. So yeah, modular, yeah, open console, but very differentiated in how they can have a go-to-market strategy. And I think it would be incredibly smart of them to pull that differentiation card and use the power of the cardiac surgeons to sort of ram themselves in.
Yeah, and I think they went public saying that they are going to start clinicals this year in cardiac in the U.S., and they're going to do their other clinicals outside the U.S. as well, but they're being intelligent about making sure it's a U.S.-based clinical on cardiac, because I'm with Steve, is that's your gateway in, and then when you really look at the Mantra 3, it's got the capabilities, as we've demonstrated in our most recent set just last month, to cover a number of cases that are in the sort of soft tissue domain.
That's a really interesting, that sounds like a very med tech solution. I think up until now, I've been looking at surgical robotic systems as as products with technologies, and the technologies would be the lure, the digital dashboards, the things you've all talked about, the towers. But to go after a specialty, like you said, with significant punching power, feels like an old school kind of med tech solution. Is that ultimately, I don't know who or what wins the day looks like, but what will drive some of these players forward? Will it be those attempts to win over those key specialties, or are we going to see some technical wins? Is it the digital dashboard? Is it the interface? Or is it a mix of all three?
Specialties that have got a lot of power, it's smart to leverage on them. You know, they're pulling a lot of money for the hospital, and they have a lot of political clout. But it will also be that you've got to have the technical armaments the same. So end effectors, mm-hmm. you've got to have the clearances within multiple procedures. I think that's going to be another important thing. You know, being just as a cardiac robot will get you in, but it won't get you the broad spread across all of the hospital networks. And I think you do have to have those peripheral technological add-ons, you know, be it telesurgery or be it a digital dashboard or be it an ecosystem or an app or something. So you're going to have to blend them all. And the smart companies are going to be the ones that see the space that they can really sort of drive the thin end of the wedge into, the tip of the spear into, and they'll hyper-focus into that. You know, be that a moon maybe doing the ASCs, or it'll be a distal doing a certain procedure where that kind of, and I know they don't like me using the word hybrid, and I don't mean it in the way that some people think of the word hybrid, but, you know, a strong laparoscopic with a blended robotic approach. If they find the right procedures, they've only got so much marketing power, so many commercial dollars. The smart ones are not going to try and spray everywhere and hope. Mm-hmm. Instead, they're going to find that tip of the spear and drive in there, and then the rest of the system will suck them in for the prostates and the things later.
Yeah, one of the things too that Steve brings up there that we shouldn't sleep on is some of the issue with some of the robots, soft tissue robots that are coming out today is, can you make the economics work?
Mm-hmm.
And when you go into cardiac surgery with a robot, you've got a different domain there in regards to the profit center into the hospital versus a mid acuity case or a low acuity case if you're going to try and apply an XI to that. So you're either going to drive efficiencies where Moon Surgical is positioning themselves in the low mid acuity and the site of care, which is a lower reimbursement in the ASC, or you're going to have to go up into the hospital setting, but you better have a very high value of deploying that robot on in an area that Da Vinci 5 is already not playing. And as Steve pointed out, throwing the Mantra 3 at the cardiac space in particular, where there's no other platform like that, and it was created by a cardiac surgeon for cardiac surgeons, you might get some traction there. As long as their IP is clear and they can operate within the US based upon, you know, the current standard of protection in that space, I think Steve just pointed something out that we can't sleep on, because the procedure value there is so high.
So What has changed in cardiac? Because if you go back to the early days of Intuitive, I mean, the cardiac was the initial target. They aim for the heart, hit the prostate. What's allowed, we're treating this as if it's a new application, but it was actually the original application. I imagine the technology has changed. Has anything else changed to make cardiac surgery with robots possible and perhaps potentially a game changer?
Yeah, I'm going to kind of speculate a little bit here, but the rise of the cardiologists and the rise of the, you know, endovascular valves, you kind of, the cardiac surgeons have got boxed into a little bit of an area where they used to, you know, somebody used to say, you know, you can judge the amount of bypass that a cardiac surgeon does by which model of Ferrari they have in the parking lot. Those days, I think, have gone. And I think that a lot of cardiac surgeons, they get left with a lot of the difficult cases. That's one of the things that they do get all left with now, because the cardiologists take some of the easier cases. They get left with full metal jackets that they end up having to deal with. And I think that the cardiac surgeons are trying to reinvent themselves a little bit and, you know, bring themselves into the fray so that they're still relevant. And, you know, robotics is relevance. Whatever you say, when you look at, you know, the marketing power of the robot, it is a very relevant technology, and it's, you know, it's growing, it's exciting, and why would they want to be left behind? So I don't think there's anything particular happened, except that, you know, things go in cycles and waves, and we're kind of 25 years since the first wave of the cardiac, where we went in back in Dresden when there was Dr. Moore there when I was doing the work back in Dresden in the day. I think there's been, probably the economic space has changed, the motivation of the cardiac surgeons has changed, and robots are, you know, it's a very, very sexy space, and a lot of specialists want to be in it. But the problem is that, you know, it's high mortality, high morbidity. It's not the area where you probably want to go with your robot. You know, Intuitive don't really go and push that there. There's a way more, you know, colons done and upper GI and bariatrics and all this kind of stuff is all done slightly easier, less mortality, less morbidity, less complex. You don't need endovascular clamping to do the cardiopulmonary bypass. It's an easier procedure, low hanging fruit for them. Whereas I think that, you know, there is very good merits in valvular surgery and in CABG surgery with the robot. You know, a good IMA harvest takedown with a robot is an excellent procedure. And I just think we've come full circle in the 25-year span.
Yeah, and what I would also say is what has changed a lot in the technology space is the new solutions that have come out that are now being delivered, you know, through an interventional cardiologist catheter, which is really doing surgery in the heart when you think about structural. So you're either deploying a stent and displacing tissue if you're an interventional cardiologist, or you're using a catheter to do surgery in the heart, that it's the only way you can access it right now without having an open surgery. And if you follow TCT and CRF, Cardio Research Foundation, you know, Marty Leon and Juan Granada, they've got more and more people on the cardiac surgery side starting to attend those meetings and are really interested in the technologies that are occurring, because when you're doing surgery, whether it's left atrial appendage, whether it's mitral, tricuspid, even aortic, whether you're looking at shunting, you're doing surgery in the heart. And we're starting to hit a wall in certain areas because you don't quite have the forces in a catheter that you might have in an open surgery. So what do I think? I think there's something in between there on the robotic side that's still minimally invasive. And then that will feed into new designs of the hardware that you're surgically implanting. It's really, you have to understand displacing tissue with a stent versus doing surgery with a valve and or, you know, any other structural heart modification is surgery. Mm-hmm. And so you've hit the limits with catheters. Now you can potentially find that middle ground. I don't know what you think about that, Steve.
No, I do. It's really funny. 1996, I sat in Norway with a surgeon called Erik Fosser. Erik Fosser was one of the first people that came up with hybrid. And he had the world's first hybrid cardiac OR. And what he was saying was, he said, in 30, I remember he said this quite clearly, he said, you know, in 30 years' time, we'll be using catheters to their limit, but then we'll also need to use minimally invasive surgical approaches like the robot to augment that, to be able to actually do what you need to do in the heart. So I think you're right, John. I think, you know, he was visionary back then when he said that. And I agree. And I think there will be a move also towards some hybrid technologies where you'll be able to do part of it from within the heart, but you still may need to apply certain forces from the outside.
Great. Final question. What's, we talked about cardiac, what new specialties might be ripe for robotics to a robotics company to come in and create a market for themselves? What, where are some other specialties where we'll see surgical robotics move into?
Do you want to say that, Joe, or do you want me to go first?
Let's start off, Steve. I always enjoy following you.
Okay. So I think there's definitely a few things going to happen in the next few years. So robotics is going to move into the endovascular world, and they're coming quite thick and fast. In fact, I just saw another new company this week that's got an autonomous endovascular, neurovascular robot. So neurovascular, some of the endovascular, as we've talked about. Interestingly, in dentistry, so there's only four potential robots there right now. There's two US ones, which is Yomi and Perceptive. Lupin Dental this week, which I'm involved with, just full disclosure, announced their first six patients for autonomous tooth prep for veneers. And there's a couple of, there's one robotic, Chinese robotic company in dentistry. So I think that's an interesting space because it's kind of a little bit different than hard tissue in surgery, but it's got a lot of the same navigation style things. So I think that's an interesting space. I think the endoluminal robots for GI and beyond, you know, GI, bronchial, endourological are going to start to come more and more this year. And it was lovely to see EndoQuest again get their IDE because they're probably the front runner on that. But there's a ton of stuff coming behind Neptune. There's InN. There's several others. So I think endoluminal GI robotics is going to start to come thick and fast as well in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I agree. There's, you know, Medtronic has got a stealth program, not stealth anymore, sorry, on the endoluminal side going on. Noah's got a stealth program on the endoluminal side going on. There's a couple other activities going on in the U.S. going on in endoluminal. So I'm with Steve on that. And that makes a lot of sense from deploying a full robotic sort of solution, because right now that's an enormous market owned by two or three people. And there's no front runner other than EndoQuest in there right now. One of the things that struck me on, you know, where, Tom, where do I think, what's the next market? And by the way, dentistry, that self-pay takes a lot of issues off the table. So you don't have to worry about reimbursement and you can charge a premium in that category. So I like that a lot, as Steve pointed out, on the aesthetic side of robotics. But when I walked away from SDTS, Eric Wilson's show, Steve and I were there, two or three weeks ago, what I realized was eventually robotics is going to become a ubiquitous tool. It's going to assist the care team and the surgeon or interventionalist in what he or she is doing. Eventually, though, you're going to have something that's going to answer the big issues happening right now in an OR, in a hospital, outpatient department, or an ASC. And that is showing me that this is worthwhile in increasing efficiencies on scheduling issues, suboptimization of utilization, long turnover times, communication breakdowns, resource management, whether it's staffing, the robot, between admin, care team, patient, and then the OEM supplying that. If you're going to market right now, and it hit me on the stage, if you're going to market and you don't have an admin function on that dashboard that when you're pitching to a hospital or an ASC, that you can't show me at least a dashboard for inventory, use time, efficiencies of the room, breakdown time, usable analytics, not for the surgeon, but for the business sort of suite, and you're going up on an RFP against somebody who has one, that is going to be a massive gap in your game. And I think that is where we're going to start to see an earlier adoption in that ASC model and the smaller hospitals in that competitive low to mid acuity where efficiencies matter more than the high acuity cases that a D5 works on. So I'm going to take it away from what's the new robot, and it's going to be, if you don't have this dashboard on the admin, finance, predictive analytics, staffing, and sort of OR efficiency, you're going to be in a world of hurt.
All right. Well, there's so much more to talk about. We're going to save some of it for Device Talks Boston. Both Joe and Steve will be there April 30th and May 1st. I hope you'll join us. Go to boston.devicetalks.com to register. Gentlemen, thanks for the insights as always, and exciting time in medtech for sure.
Thanks. See you soon.
All right, great to hear from Joe and Steve. Now it's time for our keynote conversation. I'd like to bring in my interview with Todd Langevin. He is president of Biotronic Neuro.
Well, Todd Langevin, welcome to the podcast.
Delighted to be here. Thank you, Tom.
Excellent, excellent timing. There seems to be a lot going on in the neuro space. And I know Biotronic Neuro had some news lately regarding some clinical results. And we're going to delve into that in a little bit. But of course, anyone who listens to this podcast knows that we find out about our guests first and find out what brought them to the medtech industry. So, Todd, what was it that that drew you to being part of medtech?
So I've been involved in neuromodulation for, I have to say, 35 plus years. And
wow.
Most of that was with Medtronic. I was fortunate to get a position there at Medtronic coming out of college, basically, after working in research for a short period of time thereafter. But I was a clinical research associate, graduated from the University of Minnesota, was working with Medtronic Technology implantable pumps at the University of Minnesota, and I got involved with the company at that point. And that was a neuromodulation device, and I didn't know, or maybe Medtronic didn't know, that neuromodulation was a specialty. It was certainly evolving at that time, but got a job there, clinical research associate. Spent 20 years at the company, great learning experience, great opportunities with the company. So one thing led to another. And before you know it, I had accumulated 20 years in a great company, great learning environment, and learned a lot about medical technology.
So you say 35 years. I guess I always tie the, and I do want to unpack your story a bit, but I always tie the start of neuromodulation to like NeuroPace, so like mid-90s. Does it go further back? It must go further back than that even.
Sure. Well, you know, spinal cord stimulation, number one, has been around since the 60s, right?
Good point. Yeah.
So Medtronic had a spinal cord stimulation business, you know, coming out of that. So in the late, you know, mid to late 70s, they were emerging as a spinal cord stimulation entity within Medtronic as a whole, which is a cardiovascular company. So, well, actually, one could argue cardiac rhythm management is a form of neuromodulation. Indeed, it is.
That's a good point. Yeah.
So most of the neuromodulation techniques, therapies, et cetera, have been born out of the cardiac rhythm management experience. So my first exposure to neuromodulation was implantable drug pumps, the Synchromed pump with Medtronic, and that was inbred venture from Medtronic to develop a pump for originally diabetes management. Didn't go very far. Eventually, it was utilized for intrathecal administration of various compounds.
That's great insight, and that's you're right. I hadn't thought about CRM being a form of neuro, but it certainly is. Going back to your story, so you were at University of Minnesota. I see a bachelor's in biology. Did you seek out medtech, or did medtech seek out you? Did you go to school knowing you wanted to be wanted to be in the medical device industry in some form or fashion?
I'm afraid I wasn't that planful. So I always liked biological sciences. I liked that stuff quite a bit, kind of coincidentally, I had to do a project for one of my classes, so I went over to this research lab at the University of Minnesota. Franz Hallberg is running a chronobiology lab. He's a renowned chronobiologist, coined the word circadian rhythm, in fact. And he got me involved in a project where I had to stay up all night collecting, urine from rats But that led to a part-time, you know, part-time job there while I was going to school. And then I got hired by an oncologist who got an R01 research grant to use to apply circadian rhythm techniques to cancer chemotherapy. So I was involved in that lab using Medtronic Synchromed pumps, and that's how I got involved with Medtronic people, and they offered me a job. So I said yes, and that job turned out to last for 20 years in various capacities.
So you're at Medtronic for 20 years. Did you enjoy? You're in a big company now. You're in a smaller company in between. Do you have a preference of big company versus small company? And what are the pluses and minuses of both?
Yeah, it's hard to choose one over the other. Of course, they have both advantages and disadvantages. So when I joined Medtronic, it was actually quite a small company. It was a mere $800 million of revenue. Now it's in the, obviously probably 30-some billion, I would guess, through acquisitions and so on. But it was a small environment there, really cardiac rhythm management focused. They were trying to get neuromodulation moving forward, although it wasn't called neuromodulation exactly at that time. And so they gave me a lot of opportunity, great learning ground, great experience. Medtronic taught me a lot about just how to work in an environment like that. Taught me a lot about, gave me a lot of opportunity in various functional areas. Learned a lot about regulatory, product development, clinical research, marketing, sales, and general managership. So if you're working in a large company, you really have the opportunity to expand your skills in a variety of areas. And a lot of smart people as well who can serve as mentors and help you through your career. So that big companies have that going for it, but also big companies have a lot to manage. And so sometimes decision-making is slower just by necessity, a little more risk-averse, probably in large companies, I would say would be a potential disadvantage. I did leave Medtronic to join a startup, cardiovascular startup, because I always liked the opportunities in Medtronic that gave me entrepreneurial opportunities. For example, I led a venture team focused on DBS. And I really liked that, that aspect of it. And so that's what, caused me to be interested in a job outside of Medtronic in a startup environment. Startup environments, you can make the decisions faster, pretty exciting environment. Highs are high, lows are low. When you have funding, it's great, but money tends to run out if over time you have to raise money. And those are difficult times sometimes if you can't recapitalize or go on to the next series of investments. So it's a stressful a time in a small company, but pluses and minuses on both sides.
That's interesting. So you were with CVRX, you were Senior Vice President of Clinical Commercial Ops, and then you went to Functional Neuromodulation Inc., which I have to admit, I'm not familiar with the company, but you were CEO there for 10 years, and I feel like it should have been. It's according to your LinkedIn profile, advancing deep brain stimulation therapies to improve the lives of people with Alzheimer's and other memory and cognitive disorders. What an important mission. What was I am assuming the CEO role drew you there, and that's what and your love of neuro, of course, drew you to functional neuromodulation.
Yeah, yeah. What was interesting with that company is I've been involved in DBS at Medtronic. I was general manager of the DBS business there before I left Medtronic. And I knew Andres Lozano, who is a neurosurgeon in Toronto Western Hospital. And he had been a pioneer in neuromodulation, particularly deep brain stimulation, for a long time. And he had some evidence that deep DBS could affect patients with Alzheimer's disease by stimulating a specific part of the brain called the fornix. And so we had some preliminary data, enough data to raise some venture capital money. Medtronic was an early investor there as well. And so that money was used to develop, to run a 40-patient trial to sort of corroborate what he observed in that smaller patient population. And along the way, Boston Scientific became a partner with that company. And so we completed that 40-patient trial, evidence of a signal in a subgroup, significant subgroup of patients, and we were able to turn that into a phase 3 trial, which By the time I left and enrolled roughly 70 patients. So the answer is still out on that. There were some funding challenges there. Mm-hmm. And that's not the reason I left, but there were some funding challenges that precipitated after I left. So that's why the answer isn't there yet. But yeah, 10 years focused on that, trying to figure out how to make an impact in Alzheimer's disease. That was an exciting time as well. And that's what, you know, that can happen in the startup world too. Before you know it, you know, a year becomes two, D becomes four, and so on. You spent quite a long time, and these things take time to develop, especially
sure.
a PMA type device.
And I don't want you to speak for functional neuromodulation, but the Alzheimer's space is so interesting and so scary. And anyone who's had a family member with that disease knows what that experience is like. What was, we're obviously we're seeing the pharma companies and the drug they're coming up, but what is it about the Alzheimer's space? It just seems different than every other med tech.
Well, I tell you, you know, I learned that by going to the, you know, national and international Alzheimer's disease meetings over the course of my time there. And you would go there and most of the presentations were presented on failed trials. And, you know, mm-hmm. I and my colleagues, we would say to ourselves, wow, I mean, the people that devote their lives to this, you know, really have something in them to keep going, keep going, keep going at it, because perseverance is really the key there. And you know, more power to them, because it is a terrible affliction. And I think that, you know, if you, you've got to be able to withstand some failure, and they are able to do that. And the hypothesis, the amyloid hypothesis has been one that people have been focused on forever, and there's been some breakthroughs in recent years that some new treatments have come out. I think there is still a doubt in some researchers' mind, some clinicians' mind, that maybe it's more to it than just Alzheimer's and tau buildup, and it's a more difficult problem than maybe maybe they thought. I mean, a very difficult problem. Everybody knows that, but maybe the treatment pathway, the underlying cause of Alzheimer's, maybe isn't fully understood. Maybe it is. But I think that's what's taken so long, and it's such a big problem that companies are willing to invest time and effort to try to figure that out.
No, that's a great point, and yeah, it's such a big problem, and I think again, it's such a I can't think of it. Every disease is awful in its own particular way, but most attack the body, very few attack the mind and the sense of the person themselves. So I think that really is, you know. I don't know. I think we all want to be who we are until our final days, and that's the one that seems to take that away. Yeah. So I want to go into Biotronic Neuro in a moment, but I'd love your perspective just on neuro overall, given your history in the space. We're seeing a lot of new technology in the space. We're talking about BCI companies. It's getting a lot more attention. Give me your assessment of the neuro space today. Is it where you thought it would have been when you started in the space 35 years ago? Is it past that, or is it not quite where you were hoping?
I think
it would
in some ways, yes, in some ways, no. And in some ways, yes.
Sure.
I think that the number of indications that are being focused on in neuromodulation is way more than I ever thought it would be. So my limited experience was in drug delivery and then spinal cord stimulation, and Medtronic took a foray into DBS, and then, but there's gastro, there's peripheral nerve stimulation, there's brain stimulation, there's transcranial, not so less invasive forms of administration of neuromodulation. I think that's what amazes me, is just the number of opportunities to modulate the nervous system, either with drugs or mm-hmm. or technology, invasive or otherwise. So that's been an amazing, amazing thing to watch over the years, and lots and more companies are getting into it. I think, in some ways, what I say maybe not as much is we, you know, I really thought at one time that DBS could, you know, the DBS for depression would be already out there. I thought DBS for other indications may already be out there. That's been turned out to be a harder harder indication to develop. I think there's massive opportunity still in brain stimulation, invasive or otherwise. Mm-hmm. And I think some of the challenges have been just to maybe clinical study trial design. For example, if you take depression, it's a very, you know, long-standing disease for many patients, very difficult. Patients have failed many, many things, heterogeneous in nature. And then when you're enrolled in a clinical trial and the studies were designed, for example, to show an effect after 3 months, I think that was too much maybe to ask of the therapy. So I think people have gotten smarter about mm-hmm. study design, patient selection, trial design. And so that's been a little bit disappointing to me, but I think there's lots of progress now being made to figure that those kinds of things out. And I think neuromodulation still has a whole lot of runway left, especially with the brain computer interface too. The great things that are coming out of something mm-hmm. kind of like Onward, for example, and some things coming with rehabilitation, stroke indications, traumatic brain injury indications. So yeah, lots of opportunities still for neuromodulation. Really exciting place to be.
Yeah, and the BCI is another space that's charged with hope and worry when you're talking about implanting something in your brain that could transmit information either in or out. It's the potential is enormous for good and bad. But let's talk about Biotronic, because it's one of those companies, admittedly, I have not been in contact with Biotronic a lot, and that's a failing on my part. If you wouldn't mind giving us an overview of Biotronic, and then I want to, of course, delve into Biotronic Neuro, where the effort you're leading, and get into your news.
Yeah, Biotronic Neuro is a really cool company, and I had heard of Biotronic because I had spent some time in Medtronic Europe, and so well known there to the cardiac rhythm management folks, and but it's been around since the '60s, so it was founded as a cardiac mm-hmm. rhythm management company, pacemaker company for the German market originally. And so the founder, Dr. Max Schaldock, an engineer, a scientist, was working with a cardiac guy in Germany. So contemporaries of Earl Bakken, the founder of Medtronic. So they were working on these things about the same time. Hmm. And so that was the origins of the company. So they're doing Brady pacing, tachy, heart failure. So full-blown cardiac rhythm management company, worldwide presence, and also a vascular business. And plus they have an organization that develops batteries, circuitries, assembly. So fully integrated, fully vertically integrated company with a strong presence heretofore in the cardiac rhythm management field and vascular field. So it's privately held. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the reason you don't hear a lot about Biotronic, because we don't have to issue annual reports or quarterly reports. And so the like publicly traded companies do, like Medtronic, Boston Abbott, and others.
So that would make a big difference if you're not shoving news in our face every 3 months.
Totally.
So tell us about Biotronic Neuro. We're going to talk today, I think, principally about the Prospera spinal cord stimulation system. But is that your primary product in your portfolio? Is there more to it? Tell us a bit about the neuro business broadly.
So neuro was spun out, not surprisingly, from the technology utilized in the cardiac rhythm management field. And
here you go.
So the device, has a can, a battery, electronics in it. It's a spinal cord stimulator. It's our main product today, with leads, and it's utilizing sort of just the experience, the breadth and depth of experience from the company over the years. And the current owner of the company had an interest in utilizing the technology for neuromodulation. So we have a neuromodulation business. Our beachhead is spinal cord stimulation. That was our first product that we launched. It's called Prospera. And we launched that in April of 2023 to the U.S. marketplace. And, we've got our work cut out for us. Medtronic, Boston, Abbott, Nevro, Saluto are there before us. I have to say they're great companies, great people, great technologies, because I've been in one of those companies and I know that to be true. But we came to the market with something that we thought was going to bring some value to patients and clinicians. Otherwise, obviously, it wouldn't have been worth to spend all that time, effort, money to develop the Prospera system if we didn't think we could be competitive and bring something unique to the marketplace.
Talk a bit about Prospera as a system. Does it have qualities that are obviously there's levels of uniqueness from other products, but does it have distinctive features? How does a product like Prospera stand out in what you just agreed is a crowded field?
Yeah. So there are two things. One is in this field, most of the companies have developed their own way to deliver the electrical current, so-called waveforms. And Medtronic has their own waveform, Abbott, Nevro, Saluda have their own waveform. And so we came to the field with our own waveform too, purposely designed. It's called multi-phase. Trademark resonance. So I don't want to be too confusing there, but it's a unique way to deliver spinal cord stimulation through the epidural space of the spinal cord. So that's one thing we have, but if that's all we had, and we think that's great, and we're going to talk about the clinical results of that, but if that's all we had to deliver to the marketplace, we would have a pretty tough row to hoe, as they say. So what we brought in addition to that is think of our device as a digital device. So it's collecting information from the device and transmitting it passively to the cloud, so that we can monitor performance of the device 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Patients don't have to do anything. Clinicians don't have to do anything. So in this field, what we know that sometimes, patients are not neuromodulation experts. Once they get the device implanted and they leave the clinician's office, frankly, they have some challenges from time to time, especially with rechargeable devices. Sometimes they can inadvertently turn their device off and they don't realize it, and their pain comes back, and they may not realize that the reason their pain came back is because their device has been off. And so we can monitor these kinds of situations and take action proactively. And we call this proactive care model. So we're able to collect this information and identify certain triggers. And we can reach out to patients and manage those situations as best we can. Or we can facilitate if we can do that remotely, reprogram the device, help the patient to recharge, or even turn the device back on, which happens, we save a lot of time and effort. Because if those things happen without this technology, patients would have to call their rep, call the office, they'd have to get something scheduled with the office, go get the appointment, drive there, et cetera, all taking time and effort. And this way, many of those things we can manage remotely, so we can eliminate unnecessary visits back to the clinic or conversations with the clinician. We don't want to interfere with the clinician.
Sure.
Patient relationship, of course, that has to happen and does happen. But some of these things can be managed simply by, your device was turned off. We realize this happened. You haven't charged your device for several days. Is there a problem? We can reach out to the patients and help with that.
So are you making those capabilities known to the patient or potential patients / customers, or are you making those capabilities known to the physicians who, frankly, would be glad to have you handle some of that the patient interaction?
Yeah, so it's fully transparent. In fact, when we first launched this, the question was posed to us by clinicians mainly. I don't know if my patients are going to like the fact that somebody's, quote, watching them, unquote. Hmm. And I get that, because in this day and age, people are very, very concerned about information sharing and cybersecurity and all those kinds of things. But we've had every patient that who's signed up for a Biotronic implant has consented to have the service. And we realized that they like the fact that somebody is paying attention to this technology that's been implanted into them to make sure it functions the way it's supposed to function. And we thought the acceptance rate would be high, but we didn't think it would be 99.9%. I don't think I'm overstretching that number. I think one patient, for one reason or another, decided he didn't want to have the remote monitoring capabilities turned on.
So when you're monitoring a patient, I imagine you're not tracking their location or things like that. You're more just, what are you able to what information are you getting from the patient?
So today we can monitor if we can monitor charging, recharging behavior. Is the patient charging as frequently as they need to? And they need to recharge about once a week. Some patients will recharge a couple times a week. But if a patient hasn't recharged their device for several days, we see the device going down in battery, then we can contact the patient and inquire as to whether they're having problems and try to fix that. Mm-hmm. We can monitor whether we have a lead malfunction, lead impedance. And you know, we can monitor, are they in the right therapeutic range of the device? And if not, we can correct that. And of course, we can monitor whether the device is on or off.
Wow.
And I mentioned to you that it's not uncommon for a device to be inadvertently turned off some way, by accident by the patient, through interaction with some RF frequency somewhere, through an airport maybe, and the patient doesn't know it, doesn't realize that. So we can react to those triggers. That's what we have today. And next generation device will be able to allow us to monitor a physiologic function of the device.
Interesting.
For physiologic patient information, for example, heart rate variability, temperature maybe, activity, sleep, those kinds of things, which are all important for the holistic look at the patient and other indicators of efficacy. And the other thing we're looking at very closely, we need more data on this, is we know basically whether the device is being used or not. So we want to make sure that these patients stay in therapy for as long as they possibly can, as long as they're getting pain relief. And we think by doing these kinds of things, knowing whether the device is being used or not, we can keep patients in therapy for much longer and avoid what we call virtual explants or real explants where the patient has turned out to be dissatisfied with their therapy for one reason or another. We can make sure they stay in therapy much longer.
I would think just as... someone who has in-laws, in their 80s, and I've had my parents nearby, but not right down the street. But to have someone else monitoring all that, if an older parent is living at home by themselves, would certainly be would be welcome to know that someone else is keeping an eye on things.
Yeah, I have, exactly. And the other thing we've noticed too is. Sometimes in places where patients live far away from the clinic,
yep, yeah,
to get reprogrammed, they'd have to drive an hour, maybe longer, maybe, you know, who knows how long. And for many of these situations, they can be remotely programmed without a physician, a necessary physician visit. So they can be remotely programmed through 5G networks. And we've had situations already in our short commercialization experience where patients have gone to, you know, on vacation to Italy, for example, and they've been programmed from the United States and managed that way. So that may be an extreme example. It's a real example. But mostly it can be applied where patients just getting in a car, getting an appointment, and driving and taking time off work. And that's a challenge for patients. And we've figured out how to eliminate that problem.
And is yours the only spinal cord stimulator with that sort of access? With that sort of
yes,
really?
It is.
That's outstanding. No, and they would, or they have to get an appointment, or they have to get their someone to drive them. There's lots of reasons why they might be sitting for a few days in pain unnecessarily. Well, let's talk a bit about your recent clinical trials. You announced you had new data from your Benefit 3 clinical study at the North American Neuromodulation Society meeting, NANS. Talk a bit about the trial. What did it demonstrate?
So the trial is just to, so a lot of the things I just talked about, you have to have clinical data to back it up. Right. And so we understand that, and we're investing heavily in clinical data collection. And so number one, we have a waveform, as I mentioned, a way to deliver the therapy, the electrical current, is called resonance. And we needed to validate whether it provides adequate pain relief to be a viable play in the space. So the efficacy rate for low leg and back pain is on par with the other competitors. And we're happy to see that. Now we have 2-year data. There are companies out there with longer data, so we will need to continue to collect that. But the 6-month data was great. The 12-month data, was great. And then now the 24-month data is saying what the 1-year and 6-month data is telling us. We're excited about that. And that's one aspect. But the other aspect is, are there other things going on in these patients' lives that are important? For example, functional improvements we're seeing based on the Oswestry scale that measures, various functional status of patients. So we're seeing that improve. We're seeing days per week without serious pain. We're seeing that improve. Mm-hmm. And opioid usage as well has been dramatically reduced using our system. So those are all going in the right direction. We're excited about the results so far. And we're going to continue to collect this data for beyond 2 years.
So, where do you mentioned a bit early? You talked a bit early about future capabilities. Where does this? What does this data help you do in bringing out a next iteration of Prospera?
Well, one thing we know that pain is sort of it's a blunt measure. So there's the visual analog scale. And there's numerical rating scale for pain, where patients basically on a scale from 1 to 10, 10 being the worst, 0 being no pain, where would you rate your pain? So it's one of the best things we have, of course, today. And that can fluctuate too, patients' recollection of where they were initially versus where they are today, how they're, what's going on in their life today can sort of impact that measure. So while the data, everybody uses it, it's a good measure, but there may be better measures to look at for how the patient is doing overall and their total well-being. Are they walking more? Are they exercising more? Are they sleeping better? All those kinds of things. So I think getting a more holistic look at how the patient's doing is good for the practitioners of this technology for pain, and for patients to have expectations about how the pain might be getting better, but also other things in their life getting better as a result of their pain relief. So those are the kinds of things we want to look at in the future, mm-hmm. to just round out the value of the spinal cord stimulation. And, payers are certainly interested in those things too. They want to know if patients are doing better, not just their pain relief, which is really important, but can they do things in their lives that they couldn't do before they were treated with these pain management technologies.
Interesting. Final question. I mean, we talked a bit about the advancing of neurotechnologies. The spinal cord stimulation space, the lower back pain space, is one where you're seeing neuro and non-neuro treatments coming around. And I know it's a crowded marketplace for you as someone who wants to compete and gain market share, but it's good news, I think, for patients and good news for clinicians that there's a critical mass of options out there that aren't spine surgery and that aren't opioids, or at least require less of that. Do you see spinal cord stimulators really kind of eating into those other markets, and opioids as a whole are a different issue, but I guess more focusing on spinal implants, spinal surgery that's being done. Do you see spinal cord stimulation taking a lot of those people on a different path than they might have had to go on before?
There's an effort now to develop an indication called non-surgical back pain, mm-hmm. right? So some of those that's a broadening potential indication for the field, and those patients, I guess by definition, would be not candidates for surgery. But when these patients are in their sort of last resort at their wit's end,
sure.
I think people are willing and to try what might make sense to relieve their pain. So I think that's one. I don't think we're going to replace surgery over. In possibly for an indication like that. Mm-hmm. But I think we also have to remember that by the time patients get to the spinal cord stimulator, which is, you know, is invasive, minimally invasive, I'd say, you do have to put an implant. But they've tried a lot of other things. Mm-hmm. They've tried blocks, they've tried rehab, they've tried even surgery. And it's remarkable that after trying all those other things, that spinal cord stimulator can produce, you know, 70 or 80% pain relief in these patients. So I think sometimes that gets forgotten. So I think there's always going to be those patients out there. It's a big number. It's always going to be a big number. And believe it or not, SCS is underutilized. So I think there are enough patients that need help where SCS can help them. I'm not sure where the surgery. You know, surgery definitely has its place. Mm-hmm. Great outcomes for the right patients, right surgeons, right indications. I don't think it's our goal to go down that path, sure, to replace any particular procedure that might be working today.
All right. Well, it's an important space, as you said. People with back pain are. I've had minor versions of it, and it puts you in a real desperate state. So it's wonderful that folks have options like these. And thanks for joining us on the podcast, Todd, and for sharing your story.
Delighted, Tom. Nice to talk to you. Really, really nice time I've had. Thank you.
All right. Well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this particular episode, but of course, for listening to all the episodes that have preceded it. Again, really grateful to the Device Talks Podcast Network family, and we look forward to bringing you a lot of additionally great content or even more great content in the future. Managing Editor Kayleen Brown, who joined us 2 years ago this week, is just kicking butt in content creation, and it's going to be a fantastic 2025, and can't wait for you all to see it. So again, thank you for being part of Device Talks. We would love to have you at Device Talks Boston. That is April 30th and May 1st. We'd love to have you at Device Talks Minnesota. That is June 11th. You can find them both at devicetalks.com, and you can also register there for our upcoming Device Talks Tuesdays. It's happening 4 p.m. on Tuesday with our friends at Resonetics, and it's going to be, again, a conversation about Nitinol. Join us there. Please subscribe, if you haven't already, to the Device Talks Podcast Network so you don't miss a future podcast episode. And connect with me on LinkedIn. Connect with Kayleen Brown on LinkedIn. Connect with Chris Newmarker on LinkedIn. Follow Device Talks on LinkedIn. Follow Device Talks on YouTube. And we'd love to continue to send great content your way, and would love to be part of your future MedTech conversations. All right, that is it, folks. Thanks again for all you've done, for all your listening, for all your comments on LinkedIn, and for your saying hellos at conferences. I look forward to many, many more podcasts coming your way. Take care, everybody.